collected 5 different life forms from the darkest corners of the universe. Monsters.
Collision imminent.
Invasive species. Predatory. If we don't lock them down, it will be too late.
Beware, humans! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast currently covering the FX on Hulu series Alien Earth. A power shift to ghosts has us wondering just who is the alien that will be taking over Earth? Is it the xenomorph and their little sibling collaborating with Wendy? Is it the eye who is now in the corpse of Arthur? Is it the octopus plant we're told also made it out of the least secure lab on television? Or is it, as Eddie Vedder tells us over this week's ending credits, 5-1 as the Lost Boys are redefined? This podcast is split into calm and storm sections, where the first calm section we will be discussing Episode 8, The Real Monsters, and the entire first season, as we have now seen all the episodes of Alien Earth that currently exist. However, in the second, likely brief, storm section of this podcast, Neil and I will speculate about the future development in Disney's Alien franchise, like Predator Badlands, in theaters later this year. So if you want to watch that completely unspoiled, we'll give you ample warning when we are entering the storm. Why, hello again! I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I was so sure last week the real monsters were the humans.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I can now control anything on the network. Welcome back, as always, to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping. We've got a fun upcoming schedule to announce. Obviously, this week we're talking about Alien Earth Episode 8, the season finale. Next week, we'll be back with an Alien Earth Season 1 wrap-up special complete, I'm sure, with plenty of Season 2 theories and hopefully by then, at least a season 2 renewal. We'll see. Then, friends, Storm of Spoilers is taking a week off, the first week of October, so that we can reset before we enter our Derry era. We are going back to Derry on the week of 10-12 and the week of 10-19. Dave and I are going to be diving into the 2 It movies that currently exist and I believe are both streaming on the HBO Max app, which is where we will then find, at the end of October, the first episode of the It Show, Welcome to Derry, which we are going to be covering week to week. We're very excited. Dave's already loaded up almost 50 hours worth of audiobook for prep, and
we're back to our lit adaptations on HBO, baby. Storm of Spoilers, back to our roots.
Yeah, so that's going to be, and then that'll take us, I believe it's going to be, 7-8 weeks of episodes. That should take us closer to the end of the year, where we have some other fun stuff planned. But yeah, so our next project is going to be chasing around a clown in the city of Derry. But before we get to that, there's other ways you can get this podcast. Of course, you can also watch it on YouTube if you're currently only listening to it with your earballs. YouTube.com/@DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil. That is our YouTube channel where we're going to post this episode, next week's episode, and I assume we'll keep going for Derry. That'll be fun as well. Also, if you'd like to hang out with me and play while I play a little bit of Alien Isolation, the video game, I'm going to be doing that this week on Thursday evening on Twitch, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus. I have made it quite far through the game. Obviously, only 2 weeks left. I'm going to finish this thing. I've made it further than I have ever made it in previous tries on Alien Isolation. And I've only died horribly several dozen times via the xenomorph. So if you want to hang out, that's going to be Thursday night this week. That's the 25th, probably 8 p.m. Central Time-ish. So yeah, follow the Twitch and you'll get a notification for when I go live. It'll be great. If you like other podcast things from Dave and I, you can join us over at Patreon, patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil, which hopefully you can spell by now if you've listened to all of our stuff. There, when you sign up for our Patreon, you get more content from all of our projects that we've done on the Storm of Spoilers feed, plus a bunch of projects that we've done specifically for the Patreon, including our Twin Peaks rewatch, a Leftovers watch project, and currently we are rewatching Hannibal. Well, Dave is rewatching Hannibal. I am watching Hannibal for the first time and having a very fun time with it. You will also get our adventure podcast. We drop that every week. This week's mailbag week, so we'll be answering questions and doing some discourse and some video game talk and you know, whatever other storms we're chasing. So those are all the ways that you can get more from Dave and I. Here's how you can get in touch with this show. You can send a raven, as always. This is very important because next week being the season recap wrap-up episode, we would love to hear questions from you. We would love to get your theories for season two. Really, anything that's left unanswered that you'd like to discuss, you can send that over to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We will read those next week. We have a few that we're going to read this week as well. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Of course, the rule is leave us a 5-star rating, say whatever you want. Nobody took us up on that offer on Apple Podcasts this week, so we don't have any new reviews.
Well, they took us off on the back half of the offer on the spot. There was some saying whatever you want.
Yeah. We did get 2 Spotify comments from folks reminding us that there is, in fact, cloning in the Alien universe, as we discussed early in last week's podcast that maybe we didn't think cloning had come along just yet. But if you listen to the entire podcast, which I highly recommend, you will hear Dave live correct us and remind us that, of course, Alien Resurrection is an entire movie about cloning in the Alien universe. But it takes place much further in the future than where Alien Earth is. At least so far. So
I do appreciate these comments, though, because if I'm ever part of an active Mandela effect where something I say is part of the universe split and these people didn't hear it in the podcast, these are the sort of things that are going to alert me. So sure. Thank you so much for interacting. Mm-hmm. I think I did what you wanted me to. But if not, I'm in another universe now, and sure. That warrants some more investigation.
Yeah. And if not, here's your correction. There is cloning in the Alien universe.
Indeed.
Maybe not yet, as far as the timeline goes. All right, Dave, time to kick off the calm with a few ravens. We got 2 ravens, both kind of focused on this idea that we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks about whether or not we even think the consciousnesses of those children actually made it into their hybrid bodies, or if it is just a copy, and you know, what is the POV experience of those children? Are they dead or are they actually in there? So I'm going to start with the one from Greg. Greg says, is consciousness more than memories? I previously mentioned the Bobaverse book series on exploring this topic, but I've also been thinking a lot about The Prestige lately, particularly with your discussion of copies. Spoilers for The Prestige ahead. Thanks for the warning there, Greg. I've always been a little haunted by Hugh Jackman's line about never knowing which him he would be during Tesla's copying procedure. I think the reality is that he is both, and that is ultimately why he reaches his fate. It makes me think of Voldemort and the idea of tearing apart one's soul. The Bobaverse also gets heavily into the copying narrative, as the AI drones based off original Bob's consciousness are specifically designed to replicate out in deep space. It introduces the concept of drift, in which a copy, while seemingly perfect and including all memories, still results in subtle personality differences that grow more and more expressed as the quote-unquote family tree branches out. Call it the soul or the ghost in the machine, but it's a fascinating concept. So I greatly appreciate the explanation, Greg. I'm not as familiar with the Bobaverse, but this notion of drift makes sense to me. This idea that even if it is just a copy, even if it's a perfect copy, there are going to be environmental factors that will cause changes in the way this person exists.
I've also seen this as a way that users have been showing the sort of errors in new AI image generation things, where they'll be like, copy this picture 70 times exactly, and it'll slowly change the picture into something else completely, because mm-hmm. that's sort of like how it works at this point with like iteration. So I, again, not familiar with the Babaverse, but the idea of this sort of like drift where, you know, the small errors become larger errors as you push out from the source code. If the source code isn't constantly regenerating itself, then you're copying off a copying of copy. Drift, degradation. I like drift a little bit more because it does get closer to this idea of a ghost or a soul, which I think ultimately mm-hmm. is also what Alien Earth is concerned about. Or maybe... what we see happening to Windy here is a little bit, well, I don't think it's a little bit simpler than that. And I don't think it's an either or, I think it's a both. But this accepting of inside of yourself, the rejection of a previous definition of what you were or what people told you that you were. Mm-hmm. So she's like, I'm not Marcy, I'm not Windy, I'm something else. So it's not just a cool thing where she's worried about chasing the ghost in the machine. She and a lot of the Lost Boys, it seems like, aren't totally, or to varying degrees, worried about how much they connect to their human bodies. But Windy, it seems at this point, has progressed to being something else. So it'd be interesting, and I'll get around to the Babaverse once I finish thousands of pages of Stephen King again, maybe. But I do like this idea of, does that drift allow you to embrace a new identity, or do you start feeling it as drift? Do you start feeling it like a ghost, like a distance from who you were, or can that pivot into something else, which I think is fascinating.
Sure.
I don't know how much I buy into this like Voldemort idea, but that is like a piece of the soul, I guess, mm-hmm. into different things. I do think it's either an all or nothing, and I like the idea of drift a little bit better, but can a soul drift, Neil?
I don't know. That is ultimately, I think, the question the show wants us to be asking, which is, you know, how much do we believe that their consciousness has actually been moved, you know, and does that include what we would generally consider to be like the human soul, the human identity that we have, right? That comes along with our consciousness.
Well, I think the identity and the consciousness, those are the things that it has to decide what it pairs. So mm-hmm. if you take it to like an idea of like reincarnation or something like that, some societies believe that your soul gets reincarnated based on like an escalating, you're getting towards sure. a nirvana, you're getting towards a new way of being,
and that but in most of those instances you don't remember who you were previously, right?
Like exactly.
there are some people that believe they have, you know, tenuous access to their past lives, I guess, quote unquote, but that's as a general principle under most reincarnation-based beliefs, you kind of wipe the slate clean of your consciousness, yeah. right? Like if I am a reincarnated version of some animal that lived a good life and got upgraded to human, I don't remember my life as the animal at all,
yeah.
which is a real bummer, if I'm being honest.
Well, it has this idea, if we are talking about it like a soul, that the identity and the consciousness could go on, but the identity is sort of what drips away. Mm-hmm. So if we think about it like that, then maybe I'm a little bit more inclined to think that the Lost Boys are actually maybe not the actual kids, but some version of what that kid was, which is just sure. they're slowly getting their identity stripped away. But whatever consciousness it was sort of continues on. And I think ultimately, that's going to be the question
sure.
the but season's that, going to be asking us.
But that would still suggest that the original experience of those kids mm-hmm. is that they died.
Yeah.
So, like, they didn't get to go on. Their consciousness got flipped and sort of restarted at best, I guess. But, you know, original Marcy, the sad kid who wanted to know if it was going to be all right, she did. Like, she has experienced what we would normally classify as death and yeah. is no longer with us. Now, as to what will become of her new consciousness as Windy, I have another raven for us from Larry, who begins his email by saying that he does believe that the consciousness got like fully transferred, right? So maybe the, okay, the kids are still in there, which is good. I love that we have different takeaways across the board in what folks are believing from this show. But Larry does eventually get to a point where in his email where he's talking about what Wendy is going through. And I think this is important when we talk about both the concept of drift and then like environmental factors. And then what you were talking about, which is like letting go of certain preconceived notions of, you know, what you are.
Right.
And Larry says, I look at what's going on with Wendy as akin to Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. He was a person who lost his body. He got an artificial one that was in many ways better than the original. He was human, so he starts with an affection for humans, but he's not human anymore, and he grows more and more distant from humanity over time as a result. For those who don't recall, Dr. Manhattan eventually goes and just like sits on Mars on a rock.
I've grown tired of this world.
So I think this is a really good insight into what we're seeing with Wendy, especially in this episode, where it's she has, for much of what we've observed of her in her new body, tried to stay connected to being a human, right? Like being a former human, I guess, who is now, mm-hmm, in this new body. But she's become disillusioned with the institution of humanity over the course of these 8 episodes, to the point where I think I agree with Larry. Like, she's very in the Dr. Manhattan zone. She's kind of no longer fucking with humanity anymore. And other than her brother, Joe, she kind of doesn't care about, she definitely doesn't want to bow to these humans, right? She's not going to, right, be submissive to them in any way anymore, even in a, like a childlike way. And she has decided that she is an improved version and therefore can take over, which I think, you know, when we talk about the Alien franchise and it being about humanity's hubris, right? Oddly enough, I was rewatched Jurassic Park this week. This show very much has put me in the Jurassic Park mindset for good reason. And, you know, Ian Malcolm, constantly right about the state of things, talking about how, you know, it's, we never stop to think of whether we should do it, right? And that is, right, sort of a core principle of the Alien franchise. No one ever stops to think, should we be doing this? Should we be messing with this alien species and trying to use it for our own weaponization purposes? Or, you know, should we be existing in this hyper-capitalist reality? And the danger in that is that you get these unexpected outcomes. And in the case of artificial intelligence, or sort of an evolved intelligence, they all eventually seem to come to the same conclusion, which is humanity isn't worth saving. So,
right,
we're either going to let humanity die, or in the case of Skynet, murder them directly.
I'm not quite sure if we're quite to the humanity isn't worth saving. We're getting close. I think
Wendy has decided that this island is not, none of the humanity on this island is worth saving. She's going to take that over. Whether or not that extends to all of humanity and the rest of Earth is TBD for like a season 2.
Well, that's the thing, is like, we are left at a interesting precipice for Wendy and her humanity. So she's embraced something beyond humanity, but is still, it's seemingly governed by parts of an emotional understanding of the world that come from a child. So when, mm-hmm, she's talking to Joe initially about, you know, him being food and her not being food, she has good points. But the scary thing, also Noah Hawley sort of reinforced on the official podcast, is they hear the story of Boy Cavalier about what he did to his dad, and then they end the episode replacing their dad and not realizing that they just did the same thing they were horrified about,
sure,
like earlier on in the thing. And that's not accidental, because the writers and the producers know that that irony exists there. But that's what happens when you give a supreme being understanding of a child. I think she's going to try to not kill anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think her rule is not going to work because in this dark view of that the alien universe has of humanity, that's not going to be possible. Like, right. I think it's going to be very interesting that she accidentally can start advocating for the things that Boy Cavalier does. And then I'm wondering, like, can you just disconnect from your humanity in general? And is that what Boy Cavalier has managed to do? But yeah, it's also very interesting in Dr. Manhattan because that's so much about a feeling of safety that I don't think Wendy has.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nothing can touch Dr. Manhattan. That's what makes him dangerous, but that's also what makes him disconnect. Wendy is technically immortal, but stuff like the flies exist, and they do point out several times Isaac died, even for like these ghosts. So there is a lingering threat. She's not quite Neo from the Matrix quite yet, but she's like on that way in terms of doing it. I guess the most interesting thing that I heard also on that official podcast was Sydney Chandler described her mind and her body is like two magnets that you could like force together, but you could never make them touch because they're oppositely charged. And she said that distance in between the magnets is what she remembered of Marcy, is how she thought about it as a performer. So she's trying to square her identity as much as anybody. And at first I was like kind of with Larry that she was going to like disconnect. But like the more I watch and the more I think about it, the more I think that what she said in the first episode about the scorpion in the bowl and that she's now applying to the xenomorph means she's going to run into why Joe said, tried to explain to her what the phrase "it's complicated" means.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we're just at a race on if Joe could reach out and do that before she loses her humanity in general. Sure. But yes, fantastic.
Yeah.
More of this, stormwithspoilers@gmail.com. And I haven't played Soma yet, but I do know it's on sale on my PlayStation. So guys, my two read lists between seasons and two playlists between seasons are really happening. You know what? Speaking of two playlists, we'll be back right after this.
Today's episode of Storm of Spoilers is sponsored by Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition. Made for Alien fans, built for action horror, re-envisioned for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S, and PC.
Step into the boots of rogue colonial marine Zula Hendrix in the terrifying first chapter of a two-part saga set between the Alien and Aliens films. Sent to investigate a distress call on the remote planet Perdan, Zula uncovers a secret Weyland-Yutani black site overrun by xenomorphs. These aren't just any xenomorphs, they're the smartest and most cunning ever portrayed in a game. They stalk, they hunt, and they strike with the same terrifying unpredictability as in the movies. With your synth companion, Davis-01, at your side, you'll fight to survive using weapons, skills, and sheer determination in this gripping original story.
Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition has been rebuilt with stunning visuals, 60 frames per second performance, 3D audio, haptic feedback, and adaptive triggers, delivering a cinematic action horror experience that makes you feel like you're truly inside the world of Alien. Coming September 30th, 2025 to PC and consoles, just go and search Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition.
All right, we're back. We're still in the calm, which only means we could talk about Alien Earth, but we're focusing here on this final episode. But I do have some, I guess, questions as we get into these corners. So let's actually start with our very important philosophical questions week, because I was inching away at this in our previous section all about Wendy. But did Boy Cavalier kind of win? Because it seems like he's on the edge of having a conversation with somebody smarter than him by the end of this episode. And he looks pretty thrilled by it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Samuel Blinken, the actor, is really in tune with the part of the performance that I didn't expect is how much fun he's having now that he's losing, quote unquote, seemingly losing, which is genuinely, truly a great psychopathic villain behavior, which is like the little laugh he gives right after Wendy is like run and he's like, kind of thrilled by the fact that he's now scared of his creations is really selling this, I think, great portrayal of this villain. Now, I do agree with you. He is one, I think, on several levels. One, he lets the eye, I mean, he doesn't get the eye into the person he wanted it in, which was Joe. And he doesn't know that he's won this just yet, but he did get it into somebody. So right. I think in the fact that the eye finds its way to Arthur's body is a win for Boyd Cavalier. Also a huge win for the actor who plays Arthur, who low-key just sneaks right into the second season, even though his character got killed off like an episode and a half ago. So shout out to him as well. So yeah, I think on that level he wins. And then, yeah, by finally getting Wendy to sort of activate her next level, right, and become the leader, and kind of I think the little mini arc of Curly in this episode, of going from being kind of whiny about I'm the favorite, I shouldn't even be here, to eventually wanting to be called Jane after hearing the story about that Wendy tells about her daughter in the Wendy's daughter in the story of Peter Pan being Jane and being kidnapped by Peter Pan. So she sort of gives us this clear arc of the hybrid children switching parents, basically, right? Going from Boy Cavalier is our sort of daddy figure to now we have a mommy and it's Wendy.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I think in a way he has won. The fact that he didn't die horribly at the hands of Xenomorph, also a huge win for him, right? Because I think he has maintained a level of importance to Wendy that is allowing her to keep him alive for now. So, yeah, I think it's overall a win, both on an artistic performance level and I think in universe, the fact that isn't like blood splatter in a hallway somewhere is a huge win for him.
Yeah. And that seems to be like the difference, with the exception of Nibs, who is much more ready to like kill impulsively. If it's Wendy versus Boy Cavalier, the difference is right now at the end of We Rule is that she seems less willing to kill people to do that.
Sure.
There was a couple like,
well, she seems less willing to kill characters with speaking lines.
Yes.
Indiscriminately murdering prodigy soldiers, not a problem.
Yeah. And the soldiers, to be fair, don't have a lot of great things to do in this episode, as we see they are no match for the single Xenomorph, mm-hmm. who, in a kind of jarring opening, considering I was expecting this episode to be slightly more all climax. I like that we built to a secondary climax, but given how last week's episode ended, I was like, why is the Xenomorph just wandering around? Shouldn't he be killing some people on the docks? But no, he's wandering around killing the other people, just because Wendy's clicking for him to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think Boy Cavalier did pretty good. I also think that if he keeps saying he's the smartest person, he did sort of stand on the shoulders of some giants, but might have created a new thing. Like if hybrids are not humans and they're not synths and they're not cyborgs, then he did something. He didn't make an invulnerable human that he owned the technical body of. He made a new life form that he might own the copyright to.
Yeah. Well, and for him, I think, you know, this really does mess up his product rollout for selling this to humanity, but I almost get the sense that he doesn't care as much about that now, right? Like he maybe has invented something better than just a product to sell people. I mean, we'll see. He's got to get out of this pickle first, and then we'll see if he gets back to his needing to sell this to humanity thing. But like, I think that he wants that conversation more. He wants to have a conversation with something like what Wendy is becoming, more than mm-hmm. he needs these hybrids to be floor models, as he explains in this episode. So,
And Wendy probably needs him alive. A controllable boy cavalier is having run of prodigy, which might be the only thing that saves them from an incoming Weyland-Yutani attack on this island.
Well, I think Wendy, you know, she was paying very close attention to Boy Cavalier's story. She knows that if she is going to, like, I think, you know, last week we talked mostly in the storm about theories for like how Wendy's journey would end. Would she like take the xenomorph and just like fuck off in a spaceship?
Right.
Which I think is fun, but it's more interesting now, especially having heard Boy Cavalier tell his little story about creating Adam as like his figurehead and his new father, and Wendy sort of mirroring that and being like, well, I need to keep Boy Cavalier alive because I may need him for that exact purpose, you know?
Right. But she's like, but I'll do it for good. I'm going to wield the 1/5 that owns the Earth conglomerate for good this time.
Sure. I'm going to create a world in which the xenomorph and humanity can live side by side in harmony under my rule. Can't wait to see that one, Wendy. I love her ambition.
Can't wait to see how that happens. Then I do want to circle back that I do like the line, it's complicated is what people say to make them feel better about not doing nothing. It's a great comeback line. I think it's in a very nuanced conversation. And just know what I'm saying. I'm asking for like nuance. I also feel that like small ping of guilt. That is me saying it's complicated, just me not wanting to wrestle with a complicated idea.
Sure.
In the terms of pop culture, I think you and I are into like wrestling it, but you know, having another shit week of news in America. So I, you know, that line hit me hard. True. On my fun alien Hulu subscription that came back on just in time.
I will say though, that this conversation and sort of the way that this episode approaches some of the bigger ideas that the show seems to be interested in have allowed me to forgive what I think is my main criticism of this finale, which is it's got real mid-season finale vibes in the sense that we don't get a lot of closure on a lot of stuff. In fact, for a show that has not, as of this recording, technically been renewed for a second season, they're leaving a lot of questions for season two. And having watched a lot of No Holly stuff and a lot of it being anthology based and needing to tell these sort of relatively complete stories within each season sort of set me up to have a different expectation. But I think there was an interview that I read from him in Entertainment Weekly that came out just after the finale, where he talked about sort of the assignment from FX and Disney being that they want this to have tendrils that just could spread out and make more seasons or more offshoots or, you know, and I think that this is a good impulse for them, especially where the Alien franchise is concerned, but I didn't necessarily expect it from Noah Hawley. So there was this element when the first time I watched the episode of like, God, this feels like it's not really giving me any answers here. But when you look back on it and think about some of the ideas that it is taking at its own pace, it's really in an interesting spot. So it's like, this, I think, will be a finale that we look back on, hopefully, as being just like the end of part one of our journey, right?
Right.
And that season two will give us all kinds of take us in all kinds of fun directions. But if they don't renew it, it will be a forever frustration in the sense that there's quite a lot that's unanswered and quite a lot that feels incomplete after this first season is over. So I think I'm a little more forgiving again, because I think it's got some really fun ideas that it's playing with. But yeah, the first time I watched it, I was like, well, what is this? Where's the rest of it? You know, which, you know, is something I keep saying about television in this era, which is like, hey, that was great, but like, where are the other like 2 to 7 more episodes that clearly they wanted to make? You know,
I think that has that, but I'm also wondering, like, am I just like a little too franchise plot brained, right? Because the reality is, even if this show doesn't get picked up because for a season two, because of the reality of these franchises and Disney. We talked about this really early on in this podcast, where we thought there were going to be zero repertory screenings of Alien at all after Disney mm-hmm. picked it up. But being like, they have to refresh this every once in a while. They have to do something. I think it's always a possibility for these ideas to come back.
Sure.
My like initial response after the episode was, this actually feels more like a Aliens or a Prometheus, where they like a creative was given the franchise and being like, what do you think this franchise is? Mm-hmm. And then we kind of like get to go off and do it. And all the sort of like, I made the Neo comment earlier, but like that was written with an idea that maybe there could be more story. But like at the end of that, he like stops bullets, comes back from the dead and flies. And I kind of feel like when Wendy stops Adam cold, I had like that moment where I'm like, this is a lot of power. And then when the episode ended and they're like, we're not going to explain why she has this power. Mm-hmm. I was like, this feels a little bit, you know, even with the Pearl Jam and the Rage Against the Machine, a little bit Neo flies off into, he's like, I'm going to take it to the machines, and flies off into the sky. And you're like, I can't wait to see the next thing. But they don't know what the next thing is.
Sure.
So I'm really torn, because on one hand, it
but
does.
But in all these instances, Prometheus, original Alien, The Matrix, we did eventually get the next thing. I think that's the key right. piece here, which is like, if Disney and FX don't give us the next thing, I actually do think that's kind of a problem.
But I mean, I think it'll become a next thing, because we didn't get whatever the next thing was after Covenant. But we've moved on from David, maybe, you know, like
sure.
who knows where the future goes. The idea that they take their little piece of the Alien universe, sprinkle some unique flavor into it, and then push it back out is like the most Ridley Scott, I only do what I'm interested idea, like anything. So like I really appreciate this much more than like the Paul W.S. Anderson AVP turn, which I understand is an adaptation of the comics, but like that sort of like redefinition of what the franchise is. And then I also sort of appreciate Romulus, but I think Romulus is also a little bit haunted house movie more than has some serious philosophical ideas. Mm-hmm. So I do like what they've sort of dumped on the Alien franchise here. Do I, you know, I want to see what happens to the eyeball now that it's in Arthur. Mm-hmm. But in like, if this was a movie that came out in 1998 or a TV series that came out in 2006, it's the same thing. They write themselves into an open corner, and then they leave that for whatever the next thing's responsibility is. I really feel like there's a lot of potential here in them not knowing. I think Noah Hawley did a great job of dancing around the vagaries, where I have an idea of what this series is saying, but like the bit-to-bit plot pieces are there to be the seeds for something else. I feel like we had a conversation this season, and I do give it a little bit of credit for not ending like everybody assumed it was, which was you need to nuke Neverland off the side of the planet, because how sure. can there be a xenomorph on Earth? I am so surprised that we end this series with two domesticated xenomorphs still on Earth, and mm-hmm. they're maybe not the biggest threat. And so they've recontextualized what the series needs to be. And I think the only thing that
but
really
they're still
hurt
on
this
an island,
is,
so they're still yes. sort of not, you know, like they're not.
We haven't
loose.
Broke canon yet.
Yeah.
We haven't broke any canon yet, but they also were able to end this season in an unpredictable way that makes me wonder where the rest of it is. And ultimately, isn't that what television's supposed to do? So yeah. I
nowadays, at least, that's what television's yeah, supposed to do, I guess.
Well, I mean, even before in like 23 episode things, you had like, and not ever since like Star Trek Next Generation, you end on a cliffhanger because mm-hmm. you want another season.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's also, I guess it's not just us being franchise brained, but the people making this thing are very franchise brained at this point.
Yeah,
so
I think the assignment was be franchise brained, which we're seeing with Disney across a bunch of their properties now. That, you know, all the Star Wars shows are going to end up intersecting in like a Dave Filoni movie mm-hmm. and the various things. So it's definitely big franchise brained. But that being said, also very Noah Hawley, in that You know, I'm just crossfading through a whole bunch of philosophical ideas. It also kind of reminded me of the first season of Legion, which was a very controlled, like, mental illness versus superpowers show. And mm-hmm. then at the end, they're like, and the X-Men are here. And you're like, oh, well, okay. And they're like, end of season. So I feel like the world got blown open into this new hybrid, you know, corner of the universe, which I think is very interesting. And maybe that's just what Alien does, is it's like, hey, look at this, and then doesn't commit to having an idea of where it's going beforehand.
Sure.
Unless Sigourney Weaver's like, I need to die in this one, in which case you get Alien 3.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
Let's talk about some polygon probes. I talked about Adam being frozen, actor Adrian Edmondson. I think it's a great combination of freezing and like 20 seconds of visual effects to actually freeze him in an unnatural way. But just what a smart decision, I think, by both the actor and I'm assuming the visual effects supervisor. And it's something you wouldn't really think about unless you were looking for it. You have to very specifically choreograph a lunging pose that ends in a way where you could freeze frame, but that you could also have that actor hold it. So every time he's on screen isn't a visual effect.
Yeah.
So I want to give like a nod to the unseen visual effects of that moment.
And how much of the, when she pushes him over, do you feel like he's a visual effect? That's gotta be most of the visual effect, right?
I would say that you could just do it on, you could do him on a pad, dummy on a pad, combine it, yeah, mm-hmm. something like that, without having to do a full digital build. That's how I'd probably do it.
Because it does, but, he falls in such an unnatural way that I'm like, that does not feel like it could have been a stunt, right?
That's not a natural stunt that, I would very much alter it like when it hits the ground somehow, because the body's going to naturally recoil in a way that it doesn't. But again, very subtle usage of this tweak to just make it just uncanny valley enough that we get the thing, which was, I guess, also a good point to bring up that, you know, you and I talked about maybe earlier on Boy Cavalier secretly being a synth. We had this idea of secret synth floating around. The Adam reveal was weird to me because I'm not surprised. Like, there was nothing that Adam did throughout the series that made me think, like, surely this man is a human. How did the reveal work for you?
Well, I think it's a really well-executed one in the sense that, like, I had not stopped to think that maybe he was a synth, but it makes complete sense in the context of the story, especially the way that it's sort of rolled out as, you know, that this was created as like a replacement father figure for Boy Cavalier. And that he was like the figurehead, basically Batman creating Alfred in a lab as a kid.
Yeah.
To then, you know,
to murder his father,
to be his guardian, you know, throughout his teen years. So I think it's great. It's a good reveal. And I think it's a great performance. And I also think it works really well as an extension of like the conversation we're having around what Wendy can do, right? You know, and her being able to just freeze him like that is pretty great. And again, I agree too that like the subtlety of the way that they're able to mix in visual effects with the stunt in this moment, I think something we should talk about in this corner is that the show has been very economical with the way they've used their budget this season, like for visual effects wise, right? Like we've seen so many xenomorph attacking through security camera footage as sort of a way to keep the budget from ballooning. But then in this episode, we get some like incredible close up xenomorph just stalking through the woods shots, which I think is like, is the show sort of saving its money for the right moment? And I really greatly appreciate that. And also I think we don't have this in our notes in this segment, but I do think we should talk about the xenomorph. Like, gets a lot of action in this episode. This is almost a xenomorph character episode for like the first half.
I really appreciate...
It all looks good, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I really appreciate and I forgive the designers, but I do think this was like a progression. Sort of how like Basic Bitch, the first Xenomorph was, the Olympian, mm-hmm. where it's like all black, exactly what you're used to, like this is how it is. And then this one, because we have to feel so much differently about it, they obviously added a lot of different weird quirks to its design. Mm-hmm. So like the all black one being out in the jungle would sort of feel like silhouette work, I think, in some places, and maybe a little bit less effective. But this one has just like the right texture and the right, I don't know, chiaroscuro imperfections to its body to be like really striking amongst the foliage, which I think I know is very striking because that's what lured me into the ad campaign for this series initially.
Yeah,
is that alien.
Yeah, and the other thing that Xenomorph gets in this episode that I really enjoyed, two pretty good jump scare moments. Like one that genuinely got me, the Dame Sylvia one, where even mm-hmm. though I knew that that thing was sneaking up on her, when it cuts around to behind her, like over the shoulder, and it's like right there, I'm like, oh, that's good. That is a good like daytime, middle of the daytime jump scare. you know, and then there's one later with Boy Cavalier in the hallway where he like turns around and it's right there. So I'm like, this, they did a really good job of, I think, creating something that felt very fresh and new with the Xenomorph, but also not failing to give us what we expect out of a Xenomorph experience, you know, some good jump scares, some really gnarly carnage, and you know, some iconic just freeze frames. We love that. The one perfect shots are aplenty in this one.
Oh yeah. Little Artie and Michael on the peeking around the side of the cage is our final shot for them. Pretty great.
Yep.
I was like, oh, and that's not something I would ever expect to do for a Xenomorph, but gonna be interesting to see how those two work out.
Yeah, I mean they then gave us two Xenomorph characters that are like dogs. They're like Wendy's dogs. And now we're on their team.
Yep. And, you know, she's still got some more eggs. So maybe we're building the hive on Neverland for season two. More on that next week in the nonsense department. Neil, before we get out of Polygon corner, I do want to talk to you about weight and strength of objects that are not there with the Miss Octo versus the Joe Hermit fight. I'm going to give it to the eyeball, that it is smart enough that there is a reason it did not exit the sheep and exit the cage through the food hole, like it's able to get into the cage through the food hole when Joe's in the cage. I'm going to assume it has its intelligence reasons why it was biding its time to not escape. However, this does have a thing where, in terms of physics, because the actors are acting against nothing, and this sort of happened with Nibs in episode two, I don't know how much that thing weighs. It gets kicked around and it seems like gelatinous, so it doesn't have like that much mass. But how much strength it has in its little octopus tentacles, because it gets one all the way to Joe's face, and presumably that's what it's using to pull the hands back towards it. Or does it see, but because again, there's not an actual animal there, maybe Joe's just blocking it and it has like no strength. Maybe those tentacles are just sticky and it just happened to throw one out. How did you read the octopus fight?
I mean, I think it looks a lot better when little Octo is not attached to a human being, right? Like the stuff where it's like crawling around the cage and he's like inside, that's all great. Right.
Oh, because it's trying to get the door handle open.
Yeah, that stuff works really well. It sort of on its own in space is fine. Even, you know, I think they did a really good job with the sort of implanting and de-implanting stuff where we see it like getting into Arthur's face is really cool. But yeah, it's like whenever it becomes more difficult to tell how much that thing weighs and how strong it is when it's like encountering a human directly. The only one that really worked is when Wendy kicks it. Yeah. Because it's just like a kicking little ball. It's great.
And yeah, it's like a hacky sack.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it looks kind of funny when it's like up against a live action human or live action anything. So I think, you know, that's something they'll have to work. Well, I mean, we'll see. Maybe it's going to be in Arthur for a while, you know, especially if it can figure out the language part of Arthur's brain and have a conversation with Boy Cavalier. So, but yeah, I think mostly it looks good. And it's, you know, the sequence is quick enough to where you don't sort of see any of the seams of it. But it's, you know, it's a weird little guy. It's a weird little creature. Weird
guy to act against.
Especially to act against. So I think that will be one of the challenges going forward, which is like, if the eye has more to do in a future season, they have to find a better way for it to interact with a live human other than basically do it. Cause you know, the Nibs encounter and the Joe encounter are basically the same thing. They're just kind of like holding their hands out and just trying to keep it away from their face. And it's like, all right, that's fine. But you can't just keep doing that.
Maybe it'll benefit whatever actors have to interact with the eye having seen this first season. Because I could also imagine like being an actor, they'd be like, all right, so it's like a little octopus dude and he jumps at you and he wants to get in your eye, like act.
Right.
And now they know sort of what that looks like.
And as it's attacking you, it seems like he has more tentacles than he did before, right? Like it seems to have additional tentacles during the attack than it does when it's just walking around. So all very confusing, but yeah, I think you're right. Once the actors have some game film to rewatch before filming season two, they'll be like, all right, I have a better idea of what this thing looks like so that I can,
what exactly is supposed to be happening here. Mm-hmm. Let's get on to our Brennan Parker Memorial character who most needs a union award. I only picked one person here because this to the benefit of part of the episode, they do mention, Adam does mention in voiceover very early on that they have evacuated all non-essential personnel. So the people there are the soldiers who I already feel guilty about, but are like soldiers suiting at my xenomorph.
Sure.
You know, people that I'm wondering if they're villains or heroes or not. But I do ask you, Neil, why was the mold worker not evacuated with the other non-essential personnel?
I guess the mold is just so essential. Like getting rid of the mold is
gotta get away to get rid of the mold.
That's wild. I mean, I still don't understand why the mold workers have to wear those suits, but everyone else can just walk around. Like Boy Cavalier is literally just walking around them with no shoes on and shit. So like, is the mold dangerous or is it just that they're like too close to the mold? I would like to see an employee handbook for the mold worker, which I assume also says no smoking, but he doesn't seem to care about that either. So yeah, definitely some more workplace hazard related asks from the mold workers union. And then, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the soldiers. I think the soldiers also are getting sort of the short end of the stick here because I don't think they were properly briefed on what they were coming up against because they end up being just like meat shields by the end of this. I also thought it was kind of funny that for like a few minutes of this episode, the character of Rashidi, played by Mo Bar-El, like becomes the main character of the story. And it relies on him giving a more nuanced performance than I think he's got in him.
I would have sworn for a few minutes,
I'm like, why are we following this stupid ass soldier around?
Yeah, I thought Siberian was in charge, honestly.
But she's just there to have an awesome death.
Yes. But yeah, that scene where they're like the Wendy's haunting them by trapping them in the elevator with like the false self-destruct or maybe false self-destruct.
Sure.
Like, again,
not sure why an elevator would need that kind of feature, but
what a crazy dystopian world where I'm like, maybe Boy Cavalier has rigged all the elevators to explode. Maybe the lab's not secure, but all the elevators can explode. Because that's, I guess, a security recommendation somebody would think about. Those sort of scenes were a little weird. It was sort of like a, hey, take a look at this different power dynamic that you were paying attention to. Probably, yeah, because they needed to feed Siberian to good old Audrey 2. Instead of sort of like switching back to Wendy, I do want to stick with Audrey too for a little bit, sure. Because I do feel like I allowed myself to be slightly overhyped for this.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. And the more I spend time with what it actually did in the background, instead of just, oh, it's there and treating it sort of like a monster, the more it's like, it's an interesting species. I like it as a new introduction of there are many species. And I guess as I rewatched it, the thing that made me feel better is we got conclusion on, I think, zero of the species of the five.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel like I not having a conclusion a little bit more about the Audrey 2
sure.
is that bad. We saw it kill, and that's what we saw all of them do, but they all live to fight another day.
Yeah, that's kind of what we wanted, right? We just wanted it to do something.
Right.
But it also is kind of fun because, you know, as we've been talking about as the season goes on, each new reveal sort of reveals something about these creatures that was a little bit unexpected, right? Like the fly being able to eat inorganic material specifically and being a danger to the hybrids was like a fun twist. The eye being extremely intelligent. That I think is one of the fun parts about this Audrey 2 experience, which is it's a little smarter than some of the other creatures.
Or it hunts. I just assumed it snatched things. But it's a full-on hunter, yeah.
But now that we know that it can do this, it very specifically didn't do this to the hybrids or Kirsch in the first episode, right? Because it was out. And it was just hanging there in the spaceship. And Isaac walked right up to it and got face-to-face with its little tentacle. And it was like, you know what? I'm not even going to mess with these things. I think to ultimately indicate that it knows the difference between a synthetic life form and an organic life form, right?
Right.
In the same
it's
way.
It's not like the one time I was a kid and I killed the Venus flytrap by feeding it M&Ms. It knows the difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
Between what it could eat and what it can't eat.
Seems to know the difference. It was waiting for its moment to escape and hunt down some humans, which, I think is, as far as visual effects go as well, pretty cool little moment there where it swallows up Siberian.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of visual effects, I really appreciate the challenge of the actual kill because it is so amorphous when it wants to be. If it was like a little Bulbasaur pod, like those petals would have rigidity, but those petals have to come out and become its tentacles, and those tentacles could squeeze into areas and they could become camouflaged, it looks like. So it is sort of like taking an octopus and making it a plant. And an octopus swallowing a human, you could see when it's sort of first bites down on Siberian, it sort of takes the shape of her upper torso at first and then sort of sucks her in to either suffocate or melt her face off with acid. I don't know what's going on in there. I don't want to. But because of that, it has a non-rigid body structure when before we always saw it as a pod with a little thing extending for it. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Gives me a little bit of the baby from Prometheus. I don't know what we call that thing that came out of squid baby that became the giant facehugger.
Yeah.
That one kind of looked kind of squiddy. I don't know. If we're still chasing the maybe these are all from similar biomes discussion, it was very interesting. I liked it. Really, I needed a second watch through of this entire episode to really find the things I liked about it. But as soon as I did, I really liked them for the most part. Neil, I've tried to read all the after episode breakdowns we can, all the teases about what this means for season two. Nobody, since we've seen them a couple weeks ago, has talked about whether or not more ticks escaped the Machinot. So I think we're still on a lookout in terms of creature watch. Is everything still contained to the island? But they seem to be signaling that's not a question we should be asking, or they don't want us to be too concerned about it in between seasons because nobody's
sure
teeing that up.
Well, it's interesting because it's a question that I don't think the show has time to really deal with just yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if it becomes a thing in a season two where it's everybody on the island sort of took their eyes off the ball a little bit by only focusing on what's going on this island. Both Yutani and Prodigy are sort of setting up this fun surprise of a massive outbreak of these ticks in New Siam. So, you know, I think that that is, if I were in the writer's room, that is something that I would be like trying to get on the whiteboard in between seasons, which is like, are there more of those ticks out there? And like, should we be worried about this massive prodigy city that still has this spaceship in the middle of it, crashed into a building? You know,
has capitalism made us all so dumb we don't even know what containment is in this world anymore?
Well, I mean, they mentioned in the scene where Boyke and Yutani have their little meeting about this idea that they have to be quarantined for a certain number of weeks. But like, is that quarantine built to contain these kinds of aliens?
Like, yeah, no, I think it was just a general quarantine for hope.
Yeah.
But yeah, like nobody knows what these things are. Actually, we don't know how long. So we started our flashback episode was like 17 hours from Earth or something. And they had sort of mentioned, the doctor on the Maginot had mentioned that they had sort of been intermittently starving the ticks just to sort of see if they would eat off dead flesh, and they would. But we don't know if you can starve these ticks, much like we used to think blowing an alien out of an airlock killed it. And then Alien Romulus is like, no, we don't know what kills these things until we see one of these things be killed. I don't think.
Sure.
So it'll be interesting to see if the ticks are that, or if we're less concerned with the things that are, you know, currently under Wendy's control. So the flies, the ticks, the other alien eggs still locked up is our understanding.
Yep.
And the eye, the xenomorphs, and our Audrey 2 plant octopus, they're all out and about. They're not in the least secure lab.
But only dangerous to humans, apparently.
Only dangerous to humans. Oh, and only humans that Wendy says are okay to kill. The xenomorph full-on knocks down Boy Cavalier to go after some soldiers.
That's true.
So, you know, it's a stand your ground law xenomorph. Let's go back, talk a little bit more about the hybrids. Once again, first watch, I was like, hell yeah, give me that Wendy hybrid body. Mm-hmm. Like, I could sit in jail and haunt an entire house with like casual flicks of my wrist.
Also, shout out to our weird, on this podcast at least, fascination with Wendy's ability to control things on the network came back in a huge way.
Yeah,
you know, got it. The show did not disappoint, and definitely paid that all off in a way that was like just as, if not slightly more important than her ability to communicate with the xenomorph.
Yep. And you know what? Maybe a Faraday cage would have just incapacitated all of them, because when Adam says like it wasn't built to contain the synths, I was like, yep. Well, I have a bag I could put my cell phone in that cuts off all network activity. Mm-hmm. Why do those things not exist in your super secret facility?
Yeah. What, that,
if anything,
what was it created to contain then? If not,
yeah, the this hybrids. Facility was built for them, is my understanding.
Yeah, like kind of an oversight there, guy with the brain the size of a planet.
But you know, that also means maybe he just overthinks things, or is just incapable of thinking anything could actually hurt him.
Sure.
Or, like,
the hubris of thinking that he will be able to maintain control over his hybrids, I think, is
exactly
what is either going to cause Boy Cavalier's downfall, or I guess just help him get to the next portion of his plan. It's hard to tell.
I mean, at this point, if I was Boy Cavalier, you've got a good case study. Why am I not putting my brain in one of these things? But we'll have to see. I mean, apparently he thinks of himself as a child, so maybe he'd think his brain is elastic. Either way, the second watch, I was like, oh, wait. Wanting to seize more power by abandoning my humanity is actually bad. Wendy was tricked into it. I think the kids were tricked into it. I'm not making any judgment calls on people who suddenly find themselves in a new identity and decide to take claim over of that. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, yeah, maybe I'd be willing to die if my body goes into an all-powerful robot so I then could control the world. That's probably what the show doesn't want me to do.
Sure.
So, once again, rewatch for the win.
Yeah.
How are you feeling, Neil, though? Do you want to be a Wendy body?
Yeah. So when it comes to our odds of hybridization consent, I think that I'm still in on the idea, but only if I can get the Wendy package.
Right.
Right. The upgraded package. Like, cause if the consumer version of this is more like the other kids, which
if I can't hear ultrasonic frequencies, what's the point?
Exactly. Yeah. If I can't get actual superpowers, if I can't control things that are networked, then I don't know if I necessarily, cause then it's kind of a crapshoot, right? You could end up, like the one of the two boys who are just like a kid in a slightly stronger body who, you know, that is problematic. And it's in the sense that like, they seem to be the most like emotionally stunted ones. Mm-hmm. Then again, if I could just be a kid brain and infinitely just sit around and play video games and stuff, that's not terrible. But you also
play
run
video games without using your hands. Even.
Yeah. You also run the risk of being Nibs, who is clearly not adjusting well, right? Like, you know, as much as she seems to have a grasp of like, at least as much as she is still alive, right, and did not get killed by the end of what happened at the end of last episode, she does seem to be losing it, or at least the one who has most strongly detached herself from previous human emotions. And I think that is showing me a downside of this transfer process. So yeah, I would want to be guaranteed that I would get the Wendy version of this, because it's very, very much the best version.
Right. So we know that she has like different mechanics because she was first. That's why she could hear stuff. I guess my question is, because they didn't know, or it's not a question. It's a question for season two, probably, because she didn't know, or because they, in the early episodes, say they didn't really know how she was reversing the flow of information back to the network. Mm-hmm. That she started doing that when she saw her brother. Do you think that the other lost boys, if they have an emotional hook somewhere enough, they're going to be able to push into that? Or do you think it is completely technology dependent? If you get the Wendy body, are you just getting good hearing? And could you still develop the control over the network from the other children? She's just done it because she had a really good emotional reason to do this.
Sure.
And that's what allows her to sort of reach out and hit Adam too, is because she's defending her brother. And that sort of that little emotional kick is what allows her to sort of push forward.
I mean, I guess that could be one of the explanations for it, but then it's like, well, why didn't Slightly get that ability? Like, why didn't he develop that ability as he was trying to find out more from Morrow about his mother, right? Like, wouldn't that give Slightly the at least impetus to have, you know, get his enhanced features working, right? This the need to, you know, have more information about like what's going on with Morrow and his family. So maybe,
I mean,
we'll see.
Or no, I mean, he definitely does, but there isn't a time in the episode where he, like, a machine would help him with that.
I guess that's true.
Like he physically has him bound and he hits him in the head. And I was like, oh, I would have killed him. But, you know, he's still Slightly. But Slightly does have a little bit more malice, it seems, than like Smee. But again, I think they leave this as a question, A, because I don't think this level of detail is necessarily required in a science fiction story that is about this, mm-hmm. to be like, you use your emotions to push through. But I do think it is a interesting possibility for a surprise.
Sure.
And it would make me complicate the Wendy package or not Wendy package deal going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think the bigger question is like, are the other hybrids capable of any of this? Is it just that they have not been given the right stimuli to bring it out of them just yet? Or have they not been in their bodies long enough to have figured it out?
Absolutely. Very, very interesting questions. Mm-hmm. And then we, of course, end on a cliffhanger, mm-hmm. but we end with Animal by Pearl Jam, which is, you know, great. Would rather be an animal, obviously, mm-hmm. is pretty directly what Wendy's going through. 5-on-1 is how it starts, obviously, pretty directly. I'm going to also say, emotionally, once again, takes me back to like the mid-2000s movies where every like mutant chronicles sci-fi B movie would end with a hard rock song and a cliffhanger that was never going to get paid off. Mm-hmm. I got that chill down my spine at the end of this episode the first time.
Yeah.
So good pull. Couldn't have been anything by Evanescence, unfortunately, but we got that for season two. Sure. I hope.
Yeah.
Do you like, you big Pearl Jam fan?
Yeah, Pearl Jam's fine. You know, I don't know. I feel like I'm not a big, I'm not really a big music person in general, in the sense that I don't like think about individual bands that I love. I just, you know, like having the radio on. I'm that kind of person mm-hmm. when it comes to music, but I've never really been like a huge, like hard rock person. But you know, I think this works. You know, a song about wanting to sort of live with the animals is very much, you know, parallel to Wendy's journey, right? And her decision that she can coexist with these creatures, right? And that it's not about using them necessarily. Well, I mean, to a certain extent, she's using the xenomorph, but only to, you know, strike back at the oppressive
forces.
The
xenomorph's getting a fine end of the deal. Yeah. It's not in captivity.
Yeah, I mean, this xenomorph's living the best life of a xenomorph in the sense that it is free and that it has someone to talk to, right?
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. It's a
pretty lonely existence out there for xenomorphs. So, but yeah, I mean, and then, of course, what she says in the conversation with Joe, which is this idea that, and something that Kirsch brought up in the first episode, which is like the hybrids realizing or fully internalizing the fact that they are not part of the food chain for at least most of these creatures is a hugely empowering thing for them ultimately, right? Like they end in a very high point where they not only feel as if they've gained power over the adult humans, but also that they can live amongst these monsters. They are not concerned about the ones that got away. Like it's all good for the hybrids. So,
yeah, you know, let's tear down a system without having any previous knowledge of what a democracy is. Let's see what happens. Pack Earth by Pack Life. We can't wait to see what happens in season two. Mm-hmm. However, we're going to be back next week with a season one wrap up. We usually do like some superlatives, saying the stuff we like the best. Neil and I are going to return to some of these season two questions we posed in the calm, and assuming we don't know anything spoilery, sort of muse on those some more. Make sure to write us in at StarWarsSpoilers@gmail.com if you have something you want us to talk about for that final episode. We want to talk about Alien Earth in general. I would love to hear more of what I've just started seeing some reviews of how this is sort of restoring the Ripley era of Alien, of sort of like a woman reclaiming her own body and identity mm-hmm. away from a corporation, which I think is definitely one of the tracks that we were on this season.
Sure.
So make sure to poke us in the right direction. Otherwise, we're going to head into the storm and talk a little bit more about some speculations about this alien world now that it involves some crazy new domesticated xenomorphs. See you in the storm.
I am the storm, brother. The first storm and the last.
All right, we're back as of this recording, Wednesday, September 24th, 2:37 p.m. Mountain Time. We do not have an official season two pickup for Alien Earth, but Noah Hawley has told Polygon, quote, "I'm pretty confident, given the show's success, that we'll get to make more."
I hope so.
And then,
personally,
I
have questions that need to be answered. Also, fun show overall.
Do you think, given the way that you were saying like a lot of TV works, do you think we're looking at it gets renewed and then 2 years minimum just to boot up a production in Bangkok again and rebuild the sets and design whatever new shit they need before we get a look at it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm hopeful that they could do it a little bit faster than that, right? Like, hopefully they didn't break everything down, you know, of the sets.
Here's my question. If it is like 2 years, do you think they're going to go for like a picking up directly from the cliffhanger, or do you have to necessitate some sort of time jump just to redress the actors who have aged but aren't supposed to have aged, mm-hmm. to break down the Neverland set so maybe it's a different set, maybe it's not a, you know, maybe it's a degraded version, maybe we pick up 2 months into a Yutani siege? Like, is do you think we're going to do some time jumping?
I mean, I would probably do a time jump. Yeah. As much as I want, as a viewer, want to come right back to this moment and see what happens when Yutani's ships arrive. Like, it is kind of leaving us off in a very pivotal moment where it seems like shit is very much about to hit the fan. But right. I think,
but so was last week.
Yeah. I do think that if it's going to be a while before they're able to get season two into production, especially because, you know, this does feel like they're waiting and taking their sweet ass time doing a season two pickup, right? Like this show.
Yeah.
I would imagine they had enough data halfway through this season to be able to make that decision.
Oh, you know? Neil, this is where we should talk about Disney has been having a horrible week trying to figure out what it's doing.
Yeah.
About anything.
You would think that a competent company would have been able to figure this out by now, but Disney is, you know, not showing themselves to be super competent these days.
They're like, we need a win. And so they release a Mandalorian and Grogu trailer because 2 days later, they're upping the price of the Disney Plus package.
Mm-hmm.
Mandalorian and Grogu, not even going to be on Disney Plus. I just don't understand anything they're doing.
Sure.
I understand.
After a week of hemming and hawing over whether or not they have to kick Kimmel off the air.
I mean, that was just nonsense, especially because, as we now know,
but
hopefully
it wrecked their stock price for several days.
Yes. Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, hopefully, you know, if it's your, you know, problem, but like it's mostly an affiliate problem. It's like not a Disney problem.
Yeah.
They capitulated. Mm-hmm. So like what a week for Disney, where they could have been just talking about how they're ready to pick up Alien 2. And now they just like can't. You know, I was watching Alien 2 last night. A lot of people on my social feeds were watching Jimmy Kimmel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, great, Alien 2. Alien Earth, that I hope gets a season 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, a big fumble for the company. But you are right that this is the type of episode where you would think it ends. Like, there's a press release as soon as the episode's up on Hulu that's like, you know, we're picking up mm-hmm. Alien season 2.
Yeah. It's weird.
Otherwise, why am I signing up for Hulu?
Yeah, it's why am I keeping my Hulu? What are you, like, six more seasons of The Bear? I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I know there's like 5 episodes of Only Murders in the Building. I'm not even sure if I'm going to get around to them this season. And I like, you guys are making some weird calls over there in Hulu. But you know what?
But
I did watch King of the Hill season 14. So maybe Hulu's okay. Maybe Disney Plus and Disney are having,
but they're all going to be the same app. That's the other thing they're going through, is like this transition over to it all being the same app and ultimately subscription. It's very weird to me that they didn't, especially considering that they're doing a price jump for their service very soon, that they weren't going to end this, that they ended this season without saying that they have a second one coming. It's very strange to me, you know?
And my other sort of issue with this is, we're about to talk, what are the odds we're going to see a Yautja, either in this series in the future or whatnot, but the rollout to a series that is the Beast teams up with a lady synth,
mm-hmm.
and then that, knowing that Badlands is going to do that in like 2 months, being like, this is where both sides of that Alien versus Predator coin is now, is sort of in like the team up buddy movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time there, you know, was a Predator team up against Alien in AVP, I remember when that was coming out, people thought that was like kind of a weak part of the movie, when What's-Her-Face teams up to fight the Queen in Antarctica or whatever it was. So I think that there's like such care put into these episodes to make them more about like Wendy and consciousness, and sort of push the xenomorph to the side because you thought it was going to be the front.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have the exact same sort of dynamic in Predator Badlands, which is my understanding, which is we're going to have a Weyland-Yutani synth who is talking to a former antagonist monster that, as far as I know, we will not be able to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the dynamic of this movie now. Is an interesting place to, I think, put the franchise. And I haven't seen Predator Badlands, but does seem like a little bit of a hat on a hat for these monsters they inherited from 20th Century Fox.
A little bit, but I have a theory about this, Dave.
Okay.
Because there is, Dan Trachtenberg made a comment about this, about Predator Badlands. And obviously we've gotten to the end of 8 episodes here without seeing any Yautja adjacent Easter eggs or anything in Alien Earth. But I do think that the thematic similarities are potentially part of a blueprint, right? If I were slowly and methodically making my way toward trying to reclaim this idea of Alien versus Predator as like a viable on-screen thing, which I think if I were in a Disney executive office, I would want this. Right. I would want to be able to build toward this eventually. Right. We love shared universes. We love big franchise storytelling. You know, we love people having to do homework before they can go see the movie or watch the next season of the show. So this idea that if you were going to do that, you can't just slam them back together as they did with the AVP movies, right? Like it can't just there. You have to find like an organic path toward a conflict between a xenomorph and a predator. And I think having them aligned with the two different corporations and having the conflict between two corporations be sort of the heart of it could be very interesting, right? Because now we end Alien Earth, which with the Prodigy Corporation still existing, but maybe being under new management, with Wendy,
right,
who also has the ability to control xenomorphs or at least speak to xenomorphs and coerce them.
Or anything wired into a network.
You know, and then from what we know about Predator Badlands, and Dan Trachtenberg said in an interview, he said, there's no xenomorph in this movie, but to me, that makes it more exciting. We're not involving the Alien franchise just to smush the action figures together. There are great organic story reasons for Weyland-Yutani to be in this film. And I think if those great organic story reasons are that Weyland-Yutani is still out there seeking a weapon it can control, who's to say that down the line you couldn't have a Weyland versus Prodigy conflict in which one side has a xenomorph and one side has a predator?
I mean, I guess that's true. And that, we don't know the state of Earth in many of the timelines that we're talking about here.
We also don't really know when Predator Badlands is taking place as compared to the events of Alien Earth. So it's like that to me is actually really interesting if you can sort of, you know, very methodically make your way into a more understandable or more reasoned situation where they're deploying these things against each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of fun. So parts of the property are going to be like in direct conversation with each other, but they're leaving enough tendrils dangling from each one, it seems, to where someone can come through and connect them whenever they want.
Right. Like Mr. Octo attacking a human, if a xenomorph tries to attack a predator, it could sprout more tendrils, seems to be what you're saying.
Sure. Well, and it could also be framed through this idea of the conflict between the corporations, right? Prodigy ends up having one of these things as a weapon. Weyland-Yutani is just trying to get weaponize anything it finds out there in space. Maybe if Predator Badlands is about Weyland-Yutani figuring out how to make friends with a predator, that could be sort of where we end up with, which is these two corporations trying to use these things against each other.
Or Weyland-Yutani not even making friends with the Predator, but being on a planet that the Predators consider having the most dangerous prey because that's what they want to go get.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like it could be very, very possible. Do you think we get through season 2 without seeing a Yautja? Or do you think if we're starting to throw in tendrils, we're going to see how Predator Badlands goes and then...
I would say If Alien Earth season one is successful enough to get a green light for a second season, which it seems like it's going to, and then Predator Badlands is successful box office wise, then yeah, I would say that's the point where someone in the Disney executive offices is calling Noah Hawley and Dan Trachtenberg and being like, let's all have lunch together before you start finalizing ideas for what happens next on these different sides of the franchise. Like, let's start thinking about how we could connect the dots here.
Or now that Fede Alvarez is off of Alien Romulus's sequel, does that allow that to transfer into a sequel that needs to exist for the franchise, not for Fede Alvarez?
Maybe.
Like, if it doesn't need to be his version of Alien Romulus, can it be Disney's version or Ridley Scott's version of Alien Romulus 2? Who's the franchise serving?
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, even though Fede Alvarez is off of out of the director's chair for that Alien Romulus sequel, he does seem to still be very involved in, like, it.
Yes.
He's shepherding the story, I guess, as a producer.
And Trachtenberg and Alvarez have talked. Yeah. So, like, it could be possible that we're headed in that trajectory anyway.
I want to see them try it. Like, I think that, especially given the cultural memory of the Alien versus Predator movies, which is that they are bad, which is an accurate representation. They are bad. Poor, especially in the case of Requiem, in many ways, just poorly made films.
Yes.
But the idea is interesting, right? Like, the idea, other, you know, the Alien franchise has its own sort of central ideas that it plays with Predator similarly, but having these two come together and not separating them too far allows you to eventually try this again. And I really want to see them try it. Like, I really want to see what is the earnest prestige era attempt at making an Alien versus Predator work. Like, can you make it and do it in a way where people are like, that's an actually legitimately great movie and or show that is about aliens fighting predators? It's a very high bar to clear, but I think it's possible.
Well, the Predator franchise has laid down a lot more track to making a Predator a protagonist, where I think, like, Predator Badlands doesn't have that much of a trip to go, because even in the AVP comics, it would often end up being like Predators, humans versus xenomorphs. Mm-hmm. What Alien Earth season one did is it finally set the stage for a xenomorph protagonist that I would maybe believe.
Yeah.
Everybody else who's teamed up with the xenomorph or who has sent something to the xenomorph, with one exception, it being the Dark Queen that we talked about from the comics, where she portrays the xenomorph as like, we're here to make sure your societies don't get too far. We're here to, like, level anything that pokes its head up. Mm-hmm. We could maybe be getting there. But even then, in a world, a story world where corporations own anything, I'm back on the Xenomorph Queen's side, if that's what she's saying.
Yeah, maybe human, like, society,
no,
should be
leveled. Boom. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, we're in a direction now where if it's an AVP, it doesn't have to necessarily be the tagline of the first one of whoever wins, humanity loses.
Yeah.
It might not be that at all at this point.
Maybe the only way, you know, we've been talking about all of the characters who need to unionize, but the overwhelming power dynamic is that the corporations, like, how do you even begin to unionize against them? Having a xenomorph or three on your side would be a far greater tool in radicalizing working class humanity against these corporations, right? If they felt like they had a chance. So I think it's a fun avenue to go down.
Can't wait to find out what they think Alien is about. Because I think next week we also have to figure out what we think Alien is about now, Neil. So one more reminder, next week we got one more Alien Earth episode coming with our season one wrap up and some season two predictions. Then we're going to take a week off and then we're diving into Welcome to Daria over on HBO, including the It movies. Until then, man, I guess we just rule.
Yep.